from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Jennifer White in for Cynthia Canty. Yesterday, Michigan and three other states tried to convince a federal appeals court to uphold their same-sex marriage bans.
The opposition really is kind of fading back. I don't think that they are seeing a whole lot of value at this moment in trying to make their case in the court of public opinion.
Flint continues to tackle the issue of blight in the city, and now one former resident is taking the issue on personally.
I came to realize just how insidious these abandoned houses can be. And one abandoned house can drag down a whole neighborhood.
And we explore a collection of stories written for Detroiters by Detroiters.
These are the stories that come from people who can tell them in the first person.
All that's ahead on Stateside. Tackling the issue of blight in urban communities is incredibly challenging. We hear a lot about Detroit, but other cities throughout Michigan struggle with what should be done about vacant properties. Recently, the city of Flint, with the help of the Genesee County Land Bank, has torn down 600 properties in its effort to demolish more than 1,500 blighted homes in the city. But how do you decide what stays and what goes? I'm Jennifer White, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, fighting blight in Flint, one house at a time. And just exactly how did we end up with the infamous Michigan left turn? We find out in 30 minutes. But first, Michigan yesterday joined three other states in the Sixth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals in Cincinnati. All four states argued to keep their bans against same-sex marriage intact. Rick Pluta with the Michigan Public Radio Network was in Cincinnati to hear the arguments, and he joins us now. Rick, what was the difference between this trial in Cincinnati and the hearings in Detroit around this issue earlier this year?
Well, the big difference is, first of all, that what happened in Detroit was really a full-blown trial, that there were hearings and expert witnesses talking about the effects of same-sex marriage on families and, in particular, on children. Now, what happens at the appeals court is you don't have days and days, that every case is given an hour. And in this particular case, Kentucky and Tennessee were given even less than that. And each side has just in half an hour to present the strongest parts of their cases and answer questions from the judge. So where Detroit was really a trial on the research on the effects on families, that the state's case in Cincinnati really focused on the fact that this amendment, this same-sex marriage ban, was approved by voters, and that courts really ought not step in and just change what voters have decided. And so the arguments there really focused on, should the judiciary step in and say that states cannot ban same-sex marriage, and is now the right time to do it?
Now we know same-sex marriage bans have been overturned in other states. Has this argument been used by some of the other states who have seen that ban overturned?
It's actually central to it. And we heard it play out again in Cincinnati, that one judge in particular, a Bush appointee, Judge Sutton, kept asking the parties over and over and over again, not just in the Michigan case, but also in the Ohio case, which is, why is it good for society? Why is it good for democracy for the judicial branch to step in and impose a solution when there's also the option of a political solution, which is both sides engage with each other and, using ballot initiatives and political action, reach a national consensus on this issue?
And what was the state's response?
The state's response was that voters can change this if they want to, and that's really where it ought to be left. The response of the attorneys for April DeBoer and Jane Rouse, and that's the lesbian couple that wants to get married so that they can jointly adopt the children they're raising, they said that the problem with that is it just that takes a while. And we've got families and children in families who are being hurt right now. They're being psychologically damaged by being told that their families are not real families, that's humiliating to children. And they're also being denied tangible benefits that come from having two legally recognized parents. And, you know, the same applies to same-sex couples. The attorney arguing for striking down same-sex marriage bans. In the Ohio case, brought up death certificates. And he said that the death certificate is the last record of a person's life on earth. And same-sex marriage bans mean that in some cases, people in those relationships, that what's left on that record is a lie. It's the final humiliation of their time on earth.
So what do we expect to see happen next in this case?
First of all, that there is probably an initial decision made. We just don't know it. That after arguments in a case like this, that the three judges will get together and they'll have sort of a straw vote and see where it stands. If they all agree, then someone will be assigned to write an opinion that will be circulated. If there's a disagreement, then someone will be assigned the majority opinion. And that's where the logic of the decision is honed, debated, and maybe even along the way, minds can be changed. That certainly happens. And so right now, they're probably already into the stage of justifying whatever decision the majority or the unanimous panel came to. And it'll take a few weeks at least. I talked to John Birch. He's a former Michigan Solicitor General who's argued many, many, many times before the Sixth Circuit and before the United States Supreme Court. And he said, on something like this, it'll probably take at least a month, and it could take a little bit more than that.
Rick Pluta is with the Michigan Public Radio Network. He's also co-host of Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics. Rick, thanks a lot.
Oh, my pleasure.
Tuesday's primary election marked the beginning of the end of the scandal-ridden administration of Robert Vicano, executive of Wayne County. He placed fifth in the Democratic primary, so former Sheriff Warren Evans will likely win the office this November in that Democratic stronghold. But Vicano leaves behind a huge challenge for his successor. We're joined now by Daniel Howes, business columnist for the Detroit News. Daniel, in your column today, you write that incompetence brought Vicano down. What should is he leaving Wayne County in?
Financially pretty poor. He's got a pension fund that is in some ways worse, more underfunded than some of the Detroit pension funds that are now going through bankruptcy reorganization and restructuring, and budgets that are out of whack, a lot of white elephant projects like the Pinnacle Racetrack that was open for about 3 years before it closed and cost taxpayers, $35 or so million. The half-finished county jail downtown, probably another $200 million boondoggle, and a legacy of a lot of self-dealing and cronyism that I think is going to be very hard for his successor to unwind, particularly a successor who's basically been part of the Wayne County and Detroit political and law enforcement machine for a very long time.
Let's take a closer look at Warren Evans. You said that he is part of or has been part of the existing political structure in Wayne County. Is he up to the challenge?
I think that remains to be seen. I think just because you've been around and you know and you can exude this confidence that we're going to get our arms around it doesn't mean that you can and doesn't mean that you will. We've seen this in this part of the state in many different applications. It could be in government, it could be in the city of Detroit, it could be in Wayne County, it could be at General Motors. I mean, there's been this belief that outsiders could fix General Motors. Well, the last 5 years they've been led by outsiders until January, and there's still some rather major issues that they're dealing with. I don't think it's at all clear that someone who is a product of a culture and a part of the world like Southeast Michigan and its structures and the way it's done things for a very, very long time, with one party controlling, essentially controlling the levers of government abetted by organized labor, I mean, that's just a fact. Can those people then turn around and do the radical changes that you could do, say, in a bankruptcy restructuring? I think that's a very much an open question, and I think it's safe to say we haven't seen that happen. We didn't see it at the state level until we got a different governor and we got a different legislature. And we didn't see it in the city of Detroit until there was a bankruptcy filing. Because when the city under Dave Bing and the former council had the opportunity, they made arrangements and agreements with the state. And they basically didn't live up to them at all for a year. And that's why we ultimately got to bankruptcy. And there may be people that don't like to hear that, but I think that's a pretty well-established fact.
Do you think we've heard the last of Robert Ficano in politics? I mean, what comes next for him?
I don't have the foggiest notion. I mean, as someone who's been around in politics for a long time, I think it's going to be very difficult to mount any kind of comeback, given how he was essentially unceremoniously dismissed. I mean, when you are the incumbent and you've been around, you were sheriff before you were county executive, and you pull fifth in a Democratic primary.
That's a pretty clear message.
Good Lord. I mean, it's about as clear a message as you can get. I mean, does that mean he doesn't try to run for state rep, you know, down the road or something? I suppose anything's possible. But if he did, imagine what his opponents would trot out. I mean, I think that would be a very, very difficult lift politically. So, you know, I will say this about Bob Ficano. I think he had his head on straight about some of the economic development and some of the things he tried to do. He defied a lot of people in organized labor who are some of his strongest supporters, and he went to Asia quite often in the service of economic development for Wayne County, including China, which is a hot button for a lot of people in organized labor. But he did it because he had the vision and he understood some of the things that were opportunities for Wayne County, whether it was around the airport or transportation or investments associated with the auto industry, particularly the intellectual side of the industry. He got that, and I think he deserves credit for that. But I don't think he necessarily surrounded himself with the right people, and I think at the end he was not served well by the people that he chose. And one way to always judge a leader, whether it's a corporate leader or a political leader, is by the people that are around them. And I think they can make them very strong and effective, and they can make them ineffective.
Daniel Howes is a business columnist for the Detroit News. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside on Michigan Radio.
Detroit is a city of stories. In this way, we are rich. We begin with abundance. But while much is written about our city these hard days, it is typically oriented to those who are not from here. Even local writers often pen stories that are meant to explain Detroit to those who live elsewhere. Much of this writing is brilliant, but our anthology, this anthology, is different. It is a collection of Detroit stories for Detroiters.
That is Anna Clark, the editor of A Detroit Anthology, a collection of essays and poems from Detroiters. Anna Clark and Shaka Sangor, one of the contributors, are with us now. Anna, Shaka, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Now, Anna, you call this a collection of Detroit stories for Detroiters. So explain that for Detroiters distinction. How do you define a Detroiter?
That's a good question, and that came up a lot while looking at a lot of the pieces that people put in there. There's pieces in here from people who have been in the city their entire life. There's people who have been in the city and left for elsewhere. There's people who came late. There's people who are here for a short time and left. Ultimately, it is a porous definition, but it is something that is meant to indicate that this is a book for people who have like some familiarity and connection with this place. You know, these are the stories that come from people who can tell them in the first person.
Mm. Now, when you thought about making this collection and you wanted it to speak to Detroiters, did that change who you looked for as contributors and how those contributors wrote the pieces?
Yeah, I mean, what I was really hoping for, I mean, there's, as everybody knows, I mean, Detroit's been in dominating headlines nationally, internationally for, you know, some time now. There's no shortage of material about Detroit, but I was interested in getting through that and having the more kind of candid, honest stories that people would tell one another, not when they're sort of framing the story as if, you know, in an explanatory fashion, but more in the sort of looser, I think ultimately more honest and more interesting fashion that you would just, the way you would tell the stories to one another.
Mm. Now, Shaka, you contributed an essay called When the Trees Stop Giving Fruit, and I'd love to have you read some of that piece for us.
Sure. I recall climbing high in a pear tree next door to the tree, the delicious fruit it offered. There was nothing I loved more than sinking my teeth into the sweet, juicy flesh of a yellowing pear. It's one of the fondest memories from my childhood. No matter what was going on in my small world, I looked forward to the fruit of one of the many trees on my street. Whether it was the plum tree in our backyard, my neighbor's peach tree, or their pear tree, I could always count on these succulent fruits to erase the pain of the moment. Then one day the trees no longer gave fruit. It was then that I realized my neighborhood had died, leaving in its wake an iniquitous skeleton that no longer resembled the healthy, vibrant place I once called home.
Later in that essay, you describe your neighborhood as the embodiment of the American dream, especially for your parents. What was it about that neighborhood that gave your family so much joy and that really captured what you thought of as that age as the American dream?
I think it was the diversity of cultures, the diversity of people. It was just a real wholesome neighborhood. You know, every morning, you know, the street would come alive with children coming out to play. And, you know, we had some of our neighbors that would come down and call my brother out the window, yo, come out and play. And then just the feeling of family, you know, it was really a well-knit with neighborhood that, you know, had just all these different type of families, Italian, Polish, Black. And to me, I think that embodied what we envisioned the American dream to be. Working parents, healthy homes, and great neighbors, and people that can entertain, and you can share just these different cross-sections of the culture. And, you know, it really was heartbreaking, you know, looking back and just seeing how something so beautiful had been, you know, stripped down to just the bare bones.
Do you remember the change? Do you have a moment in your mind or a time period that you identify as being the tipping point?
Yeah, I think the tipping point was around 1986 with the introduction of crack cocaine. The neighborhood went from homeowners and families to renters and, you know, drug dealers, drug users. And it was just this marked difference that you can see, you can feel. You know, on the corner of our block, we used to have Chrysler dealership. You know, that moved out and Focus Hope moved in. A lot of the mom-and-pop stores in the community were taken over by either big corporations or people who didn't come from the community and didn't have a sense of what that neighborhood really meant to us. The small diners were replaced by fast food restaurants. And so a lot of these things happened incrementally, but then there was just that point in like 86 where just you knew it was different. You know, houses that were once abandoned and immediately occupied were abandoned for extensive periods of time and vandalized, and nobody thought to do anything about it. And that's when the real shift began.
When you use that image of the trees not bearing fruit anymore, is that also a stand-in for the people?
Definitely, definitely. You know, when I think about my experience of growing up and being able to climb those trees and be able to rely on them for nourishment, it reminded me of what the community represented to us, like the elders in the community were nourishing to the youth. And I think that we brought a sense of vitality to them. One of my neighbors, him and his wife, you know, I would just go sit on their porch and I was like one of their grandkids. And this was every day. And he loved to listen to like the radio blogs, and they had a little dog named Susie, and we were like family. And so it was an exchange of generations, and, you know, whatever was going on in my wonderful world of childhood that they received, you know, also got a chance to absorb some of the wisdom from him and his wife. And then plus they always had great treats. So. But it just reminded me of, like, you know, what those trees represented. And then when the neighborhood changed, people that no longer even saw the value in ensuring that those trees were nourished, and a lot of them died off and became more of a nuisance to the people moving in the neighborhood as opposed to something of substance and value.
Anna, many of the stories in the collection are dark. And while you can't control who reads the stories, so people may read them and say, oh, gosh, this is not a great picture of Detroit. Were you concerned about that?
Well, I think that, I mean, I definitely did notice that. And I think there would have been room for more funny stories, some of the more lighter things. You know, of course, that's as true as anything else. But it was interesting to see what people wanted to write about when given the opportunity. And I think a lot of people did want to explore these, like, really pivotal transformational moments. It seemed again and again, like, people turned to, like, stories of home, you know, and changing neighborhoods, and whether it was their own, how they experienced it themselves, or going back with their grandparents and hearing stories about it and trying to picture it. I think that what I hoped to do with this book was not to, like, make it so much about positive stories about Detroit or negative stories, but being true stories. I think the contributors themselves define what that means.
Mm-hmm. Shaka, when you think about your essay and you think about some of the other essays or poems in the collection, what do you hope people take away from these stories, whether they are Detroiters or people reading about Detroit?
What I really hope people take away from the stories is the journey. You know, I travel a lot, and you know, when people are like, where are you from? I'm like, from Detroit. And it's kind of like that moment where they freeze and they don't know what to say, because the way Detroit has been ushered into the public space has been so negative. And I think if people really understand the journey, they understand the country in a larger context.
Explain that.
And what I mean is, like, so Detroit at one time was this hustling, bustling center of so much activity, you know, entertainment, you know, obviously the auto industry, and with outsourcing of jobs and things like that had a devastating impact on a really central part of the nation. And I think when we can look at it in a larger context and understand it as not this isolated island, because that's how it feels sometimes, that people think that Detroit is just this isolated space, and not realizing so many of the great things that have came about came out of Detroit. You know, like, you know, Motown is the soundtrack of the world that we live in growing up. And you just think about, you know, cars, like we started that in the D, you know, and people sometimes forget the connection to our overall history. And so I really want them to just, you know, get a glimpse of is the real life perspective, you know, the real people. I think Detroit has some of the most resilient people in the world. Of all the places I've traveled, you know, because we've gone through so many ups and downs, yet we still remain strong. And so I don't think that you can really understand that until you understand the journey that we've all gone through.
Anna, what do you hope people take away from the collection?
That the story of Detroit isn't a sociological case study or some sort of example of a lot of, like, it's not a metaphor, it is a place of lived experiences, you know, that there is a really diverse set of people who have had connections and experiences here, and that they have different tones of their voices, they often disagree with each other, they have stories that echo each other, and it's incredible, and it's exciting, and that energy of the city is really in the people who have made a home here one way or another.
Shaka, when's the last time you went back to your neighborhood?
I go frequently, actually. I was just over, and I've grown up in several neighborhoods throughout Detroit, from the east side to the west side, but I was just doing a documentary over in one of my neighborhoods in Brightmoor, which is on the west side of Detroit, and it is by far one of the hardest hit neighborhoods, and so I ride through there often, just sometimes to get a perspective of, you know, where I'm at in my life today. But it's interesting, you know, it's interesting when you take people over there, and it's, you know, it's one house on the block, and the rest is just overgrown shrubbery and things like that. But there's still, like, this sense of peace and calmness that I find in the midst of the chaos. And so, you know, I try to get back through there, you know, as frequently as possible. You know, and I go in different neighborhoods in Detroit. I'm actually one of them type of Detroiter that just sees Detroit as my neighborhood, because I've lived in so many different spaces and have family all over. And I just love to connect with real people. So, yeah.
Do you hope to see a reblossoming of the neighborhood you grew up in, the neighborhoods you grew up in?
I don't think that it will ever reach the level that it was back then, but I'm looking forward to something new and fresh emerging. I'm optimistically cautious. There's a lot of change taking place in Detroit that doesn't always reflect the history and the respect of those who have been there for years. And I think that, you know, in my big picture view is that we will reemerge as a different type of city, but a city that's more connected based on our history and legacy of what it means to be a neighbor, what it means to be able to go get a cup of sugar or a stick of butter next door and know that it's given with love and compassion, and that, you know, these shared experiences are important to all of us, not just some of us.
Anna, Shaka talked about the diversity in his neighborhood growing up, and one of the things I hear from people is that they feel like there's only a picture of Detroit presented in the media, and that it's very one-dimensional. Do you feel like you captured Detroit in its wholeness in this collection?
I think the city is too big to be captured in any one book, but I do think that the contributors to this, the writers and the photographers and the artists, put together a picture that is much more complicated and diverse and complex than I think is often seen. I feel like there's a phrase that was sort of popularized by the Nigerian author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie about the danger of the single story. And she was talking particularly about where she came from. I think Detroit's had some of the same challenges of having a single story told about it, which leaves out so much else. And I feel like if this helps open up some of the space for the true wealth of textured stories from this place, then I would be glad.
Anna Clark is the editor of A Detroit Anthology, a collection of essays and poems from Detroiters. We were also joined by Shaka Sangor, one of the contributors to the collection. Anna, Shaka, thanks so much for joining us here on Stateside.
Thank you
for having us.
This is Stateside. I'm Jennifer White, in for Cynthia Canty. There is a verdict in the trial of Theodore Wafer. The Dearborn Heights homeowner was convicted of second-degree murder and manslaughter in the porch shooting of 19-year-old Renisha McBride. Michigan Radio's Detroit reporter Sarah Swick has been following the trial, and she joins us now. Sarah, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, Jen, good to be back here.
So remind us briefly of the circumstances surrounding this case.
Okay, so this was a case where Mr. Wafer, the Dearborn Heights homeowner, shot Renisha McBride on his front porch. And what happened is Ms. McBride apparently came to his door, pounding on his door, as he put it, around 4:30 in the morning last November. And we know that several hours earlier she had crashed her car in Detroit, fairly nearby. We don't know where she was in the hours between then and when she showed up on Mr. Wafer's porch. We don't know why she was there. We can only sort of speculate that she, in addition to being intoxicated, maybe had a concussion or some other kind of disorienting head injury from the car accident. But in any case, Mr. Wafer claimed he acted in self-defense, but apparently the jury didn't buy that. They said he had opened the door and he shot her through the door. And that was the prosecution's contention, and apparently the jury agreed.
And the prosecution really framed Wafer as someone who was looking for a fight. They said he could have called 911. He didn't have to come to the door with a loaded gun. And apparently that argument worked with the jury.
Yeah, during the trial, they brought up several sort of incidents that had happened in that Dearborn Heights neighborhood. What really sort of sounded like more or less minor vandalism. They kept referring to a case where Mr. Wafer's car had been paintballed about a month earlier, and Wafer claimed that he had, in fact, loaded his shotgun at some time around that incident, and he claimed that he had forgotten that the gun was, in fact, loaded when he took it to the front door and when he eventually did shoot Renisha McBride. But the prosecution painted a picture of a guy who was angry, who felt afraid in his home, but that was looking for a confrontation, who opened the door angry. And those were sentiments that Renisha McBride's parents actually echoed when they spoke briefly after the verdict today.
Now, this case really did put a highlight on some of the racial tension that still exists in Michigan. Wafer, of course, is an older white man. Renisha McBride, a very young black woman. And there's been racial tension between Detroit and Dearborn and Dearborn Heights for a long time. Did we see that play out in the case as well?
I think the specter of race was always sort of lingering in the background of this case, but it didn't actually come up much directly during the trial, Wafer claimed. He really couldn't even see the person he had shot, you know, even whether it was a man or a woman, much less their race. And Renisha McBride's parents, again, speaking just after the verdict now, said that, you know, it's obviously hard to sort of divvy up what people's motivations may have been at the time and speculate, but they said they don't believe that Wafer necessarily targeted their daughter or that it was necessarily primarily racially driven, but basically that he was an angry guy and she was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and she was the one who was unlucky enough to show up on his front porch that early that morning.
But this case did gain national attention because it harkened back to the Trayvon Martin case, and that became part of the narrative around the McBride and Wafer incident.
Yes, it did. And again, I think there was and is definite sort of racial overtones and elements, especially since you noted there's been this tension between sort of Detroit and the inner suburbs and dividing lines and roads and things like that. This sort of happened on that dividing line between Detroit and Dearborn Heights. But I think given how little it actually, race itself actually came up during the trial, and now that Wafer has been found guilty, I think that this race won't necessarily stay as the sort of defining narrative of this case like it was with Trayvon Martin, although, again, it will always be there in background like it is in so many things in Detroit.
Now, Theodore Wafer will be sentenced on August 21st. Do we have any idea about what his sentence could be?
His sentence could be up to life in prison, but we don't necessarily expect it will be quite that harsh. But we also, since it is a second-degree murder charge, can expect that it'll be pretty significant. So we'll have to see whether the judge takes his age into account. He's 55, or relative lack of a criminal record, but it should be a significant sentence, I would think.
Sarah Swick is Michigan Radio's Detroit reporter. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Jennifer White in for Cynthia Canty. Tackling the issue of blight in urban communities is incredibly challenging. A vacant home isn't just an eyesore. It can also become a haven for crime, and abandoned homes are more likely to be the source of fires, further stressing already strained public safety resources. Recently, the city of Flint, with the help of the Genesee County Land Bank, has torn down 600 properties in their effort to demolish more than 1,500 blighted homes in the city. It's part of the Michigan Blight Elimination Plan with support from the hardest hit federal grant fund. Here now is Doug Weiland, Executive Director of Genesee County Land Bank. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being on.
So far, 600 homes have been demolished, but there are at least 1,000 more properties that need attention. How do you decide what stays and what goes?
Well, for one thing, there was some criteria issued by the state through MISHTA on the hardest hit funds, and through the Michigan Land Bank, which is part of MISHTA, with regard to the Michigan Blight Elimination Grant. Both of them help define kind of geography and areas, but some of the criteria had to do with taking down, for in priority order, blighted properties that were near schools that were operating, major street corridors in the city, in traditional neighborhoods where we still have a fairly good population density.
How do you feel about the progress that's been made so far? Are things moving quickly enough in Flint?
We are right on schedule. Our plan calls for having just about all of the properties done or down in November. We have a work plan that is on schedule. We have, as you said, about 600 properties that are down, another 1,000 or more that are in progress. So the 1,000 that are in progress are a combination of utility cuts have been made, environmental abatements have been done, and we're now moving ahead with the actual demolition of the property. So we feel good about the progress. It can never happen fast enough for those of us who do this work. We'd like to see it go faster, but there are a lot of different processes that have to be done kind of in order to prepare for doing a demolition, including all the utility cuts, electric, gas, water, getting environmental inspections done to see if there's asbestos in the house or if there are other hazardous materials, then getting contractors to go out and remove the asbestos, remove hazardous materials, and then bidding out the actual demolition work.
Well, clearly there are some challenges in tackling this level of blight. Where are the opportunities in this issue for Flint?
Well, the opportunities really are around the results of doing demolition. As you said in your opening, blighted properties breed crime, they are arson targets, and they create a lot of different health and social issues for the population. So this is a great opportunity for us to remove some 1,600 or more houses that are blighted and present those problems. One benefit that we've just learned of here within the last week or so, there was a report from the city of Flint that arsons and arson fires in the city of Flint were down something like 58%. And they are saying is in part due to the fact that all of this demolition is taking place. So we're taking a lot of these arson fires and other accidental fires out of the equation because blighted, vacant properties are just sitting there waiting to be set on fire.
Doug Weiland is Executive Director of the Genesee County Land Bank. Doug, thanks for speaking with us.
No problem. Thank you for calling.
Now, some people are taking a very personal approach to dealing with blight in Flint. There's a crowdfunding campaign going on right now that hopes to raise $10,000 to tear down a single crumbling home on Park Belt Drive. Gorton Young is spearheading the project. He's the author of the book Tear Down, Memoir of a Vanishing City, and he runs the Flint Expatriates blog. And he's joined today by Crystal Ashburn Brown. She's a resident of Flint who lives on Park Belt Drive. Welcome to you both.
Hey, thanks, Thank Jennifer.
You.
Glad to be here.
Now, Gorton, as indicated by the name of your blog, you're an expat of Flint. You live in San Francisco now. What made you embark on this campaign?
I think like a lot of people who grew up in Flint but no longer live there for economic reasons, I just wanted to try and help the city in some way. Flint made me who I am, and I want to stay connected to it, even though, like you said, I've lived in San Francisco now for almost 20 years. And I think there's a lot of other people like me that want to help the city in some way.
Well, you're working with the Genesee Land Bank, and you've created this Indiegogo campaign. What are you really trying to accomplish? Is it just about tearing down this house?
Well, I think sometimes you can get overwhelmed by the problems facing shrinking cities like Flint and Detroit. And when you start looking at the big picture, you start wondering, what can one person do? So what I wanted to do was connect with residents like Crystal and really focus on something that was manageable that we could accomplish. And that's why we kind of concentrated on this one house, because it's the only abandoned house on this block, and otherwise the block is in amazing shape. So we want to tackle this one small problem before it expands.
Well, Crystal, you live on Park Belt. Your family has owned the home you live in since 1971. Has there been many changes to your street over time, or has it stayed pretty stable?
My neighborhood has been pretty stable. This is the first abandoned house we had that looked like this. We didn't have the abandoned homes, but over a period of time, somebody come in and buy the house and fix it up, and, you know, it looks nice and everything. But this house right here, this is the first time it ever happened.
Can you describe this house to us, Crystal?
Yes, it's an abandoned home. It was once owned by a family that owned a furniture store down on Harrison Street years ago. One thing to think, the husband worked at a real estate. He sold real estate, and the wife had the furniture store. And the husband died first, and then the wife died maybe 2 years ago. The son walked away and just abandoned the house.
Has it become a place that's attracting the wrong sorts of attention?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We had high school students were going in and out the house all through last school year. We had squatters in the home. We had an incident where a squatter, when they left out the house on a Sunday, when they walked out, the house caught on fire. And we think that they were standing in the house trying to stay warm, and they must have made a fire or something. Anyway, it caught the house on fire. So the house is pretty much covered up with bushes, trees. The backyard looked like a forest. You can't even get back there. And then you have like a big old hole in the back of the house where you just can walk in.
Gordon, how did you hear about this home?
Well, in the process of writing my book, I was connecting with a lot of people, and I came to realize just how insidious these abandoned houses can be. I mean, one abandoned house can drag down a whole neighborhood eventually. And so I started to think about, what could I do to help with this problem? And I hunted around and talked to people I knew and was trying to find the right house. And eventually I got in touch with the Genesee County Land Bank, and I told them what I was trying to do, and they were enthusiastic about it. And I emphasized to them, as much as we need to tear down a lot of the abandoned homes in Flint, I'm not sure tearing down one house on a block with 20 other abandoned houses is really going to have a huge impact. And I told them, I'm looking for a house that's hurting an otherwise healthy neighborhood. And they connected me with Crystal and some of the other neighbors on Park Belt and said, this is exactly what you're looking for, because this block doesn't have any other problems except this one house. And it would really be helpful if you wanted to try and raise some money to eliminate this problem. And I know it's kind of a weird crowdfunding campaign, because usually these crowdfunding campaigns are people who are, you know, they're making a movie or they're pursuing their life dreams and trying to raise money for it. In a way, on the surface, this seems kind of destructive, right? We're tearing something down. But in a shrinking city like Flint, sometimes creating a vacant lot really is a creative act, because an abandoned, burned-out house like this can really make you feel hopeless. The vacant lot has some potential. It has a future instead of just a past.
You know, I'm thinking about the potential of that space, Crystal. I'm curious about what you'd like to see done with that property. If the campaign is successful and you end up with this vacant lot, what would you like to see there?
Well, the lady next to it, Miss Paulette, that was one of the ones that Gordon contacted too. He talked to Paulette. I know me and her had talked, and we thought about a couple of neighbors going in and purchasing that lot. My idea with the lot is to keep it cut and keep it well manicured. I like to even put like some picnic tables to sit around if you want to go over and sit around. Make it like a little park-like, but only for the neighbors that's on the street. No outside neighbors can come and use the park.
Gordon, what about you? Is this, you know, once the house is gone, do you consider yourself done with the project, or will you continue to see what happens with that space?
Well, I'd like to see what happens. I'd like to stay in touch with folks on the block, definitely. But for me, I think I've become very realistic about the situation. I would just be happy to see the house gone, and then the people on the block can do what they want with the lot. Anything is going to be better than what we have now. So I think once the house is gone, there's all these possibilities that would be great.
Crystal, I'm curious, you know, you're on a block that's stable, but when you look at the city as a whole and you think about the number of vacant homes and properties, you know, how big of an issue is blight in the city, and how does it make you feel about living in Flint?
Well, I was born and raised here, so I've been here all my life, and I'm 57 years old. And when I ride around, I'm a person to do a lot of riding, me and my husband, and we always go back to the neighborhood that we both was raised. Before I came here on Parkville Street, I lived at on McClellan Street, and that's on the north end as well. And when I ride through my neighborhood and see it, you know, my house was tore down. Where he lived at, his house was tore down. But, like, on my block, it's probably about maybe five houses left. So, and that's just one block. But the whole area on that north end, you know, you can ride down some streets, you may see one home. You can ride down some streets and you don't see no houses. It hurts me to see our city like this. And I just, in my mind, I'm just wondering, how did it ever get so bad? How did it get out of control? Because it's throughout the city. You know, it's not just one part of the city. It's throughout the whole city. You know, and I look over here where I'm at now, on our block, we just have the one house, but you can look on other streets and you don't see a lot of houses that's vacant or just tore down. You don't see a whole lot of it. So I was just saying, if they can just help save this block, that way where it's one house won't start a trend of other houses becoming like this house. Try to save the nice blocks.
And so that'll feel like a real victory for you if you're able
to.
Yeah,
it's a big victory. That way you can kind of stabilize it a little bit. You know, you just can't keep letting nice blocks and people who are trying to take care of their property, letting one house destroy a whole block. See, our property is going down. You know, we have one lady, which is Paulette, her house is a rental house. That was her house that she was raised up in. Okay, she have a hard time trying to rent it out because of the house next door. You understand what I'm saying? Mm. And then people look at the house next door, they don't want to rent out her house. And I can't blame them. You know, she finally got a family over there now. The guy, he keeps his house, his yard cut, and he keeps the vacant property cut. But his kids can't go in the backyard because the house next door is too dangerous.
Gordon, when you look at this small, I guess, drop in the bucket, and you look at Flint as a whole, you know, how important is it for you to meet the goal of this campaign personally?
It's pretty huge. I feel like I've really tried hard to reconnect with Flint, and the city meant a lot to me. Four generations of my family lived there, and the city meant a lot to the country. It helped build the middle class in the United States. And I feel like, again, we just can't be overwhelmed by the larger issues that are affecting Flint. And if we want to try and help it, I think it's going to be a series of small steps. As individuals, it's hard for us to do something against these big forces that are working on these cities. It's Crystal and I can't solve deindustrialization. We can't affect U.S. trade policy. We can't affect corporate decision-making that led to the loss of 70,000 jobs in Flint when GM had layoffs. So we got to concentrate on what we can do, and this is something we can do.
So how is the campaign progressing so far?
It's doing great. We still have until August 22nd is the last day. We've raised $5,800, so we're 58% toward our goal, and we've still got a lot of time left. But we still need more donations. It's an all-or-nothing campaign, so if we don't get our $10,000 goal, which is roughly what you need to tear down the average house, all the money goes back to the donors. So it's all-or-nothing. We're off to a great start, but we still need some donations to finish it off.
If people want to learn more about what you're doing, where should they go?
There's a website on Indiegogo, and if you Google Indiegogo in Flint, Michigan, it's the first thing that pops up. You can also go to FlintExpats.com, which is my blog, and I have a lot of information about how to get to the Indiegogo site so people can make a donation via PayPal or with a credit card.
Gordon Young is author of the book Teardown, Memoir of a Vanishing City. He runs the Flint Expatriates blog, and Crystal Ashburn Brown is a resident of Flint. Best of luck in this campaign. We'll definitely check in with you to see how things went.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer.
You're listening to Stateside.
What?
When?
Why? Who?
Where?
How?
I am curious.
This summer, we began our Am I Curious project. Reporters at Michigan Radio are trying to find answers to your questions. A few weeks ago, Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick looked into why so many people from the Middle East immigrated to Dearborn. And we're in the middle of answering our latest winner's question. That's about the status of the aged Enbridge oil pipeline that runs through the Straits of Mackinac. But in the meantime, we wanted to give a little love to one of our Am I Curious runners-up. Nick Ochall wanted to know about the origins of the infamous Michigan left turn, the bane of my early driving experience, along with parallel parking. So for the answer, we turn to Joseph Hummer. He's with the College of Engineering at Wayne State University. Hello, Joe. Welcome.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So the Michigan left turn has a curious history. Tell us about it.
It started actually with streetcars in Detroit. The streetcars needed a wide median in the road to make their way up and down. When the streetcars were being disassembled in the late 1950s, Detroit was left with a lot of streets that were really too wide, that had medians that were too wide. And traffic does not move well at an intersection with a wide median because the left turn traffic tends to lock up with each other, kind of locking up the median opening. So the engineers in Detroit and Michigan Department of Highways in those days thought about what to do about that, and the solution became, let's prohibit left turns in those median openings and reroute those downstream either way to a median opening. So the Michigan left turn grew out of that need to solve a problem that was created by the disappearance of the streetcar lines.
Now, Michigan isn't the only state that used streetcars, but was this, you know, our special snowflake, or did other states come up with the same solution?
The other place that this design appeared was in New Orleans, Louisiana, and that's because they have a lot of streets with canals running down the middle. And so a similar type of street geometry, a different reason, but similar type of street geometry, and they came up with a similar solution. Other states with streetcars and wide medians and the need to remove those streetcars came up with other solutions. This one appears to be the solution for Michigan and for Louisiana.
So if I went to Louisiana, would I still make a Michigan left turn, or at that point is it a Louisiana left turn? Who gets to claim the name?
Well, we certainly claim the Michigan left turn. They and the rest of the world call this design a median U-turn, and that's fine with most of us.
I think I'm going to stick with the Michigan left turn. It's more fun.
It works for me.
Joe Hummer is with the College of Engineering at Wayne State University. Joe, thanks for bringing us the answer to this question.
Sure, my pleasure.
And a new round of voting ends tomorrow. Let us know what you want to find out about or submit a question of your own for our Am I Curious project. Head to MichiganRadio.org and click the link that says, What Are You Curious About? Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Skahn. Contributors are Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Kayla Steinberg, and Michelle Hahn. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Jennifer White. Thanks for listening.